Resource Subcommittee of the Joint Ways and Means to order. And we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2899. Would you present the bill to us?
House Bill 2899A makes the performance standards for wetlands mitigation banks consistent with the standards for individual compensatory mitigation of wetlands. When a property owner seeks a state permit from the Division of State Lands to alter a wetland, the owner is required to replace or mitigate the wetland by improving, creating, or restoring another area to compensate for the wetland disturbed by the permitted activity. A wetland mitigation bank is a larger wetland restoration, creation, or enhancement effort used to offset many anticipated smaller wetland impacts. The mitigation bank replaces wetland function loss due to development when there are no other feasible options to replace that function on sites being developed. Banks are usually large blocks of wetlands operated by a private individual or government agencies who sell credits to others unable to make up for wetland function destroyed by development on another site. The bill authorizes the Division of State Lands to utilize funds in the Oregon Wetlands Mitigation Bank Revolving Fund and prioritize expenditures from the fund. Okay. It further clarifies that only the Division of State Lands may determine or verify who has jurisdiction over state wetlands. Changes made by the bill are expected to make creation and use of wetlands mitigation banks more attractive. The Division of State Lands spent about $600,000 from the revolving fund in 1901 and believes that they will spend about $293,000 during the current biennium.
Questions of the committee?
Senator Farioli.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I wanted to talk to the relating clause of this bill, perhaps more than the bill itself. I've got a whole series of issues that I've been wrestling with, and I think many of our members have had the same sort of problems, especially with small communities. First of all, we know that within the urban growth boundaries and certainly within the city limits, we have significant acres of wetlands. And in an earlier hearing this year, of course, I met some of the world's experts on wetland function and form. And there are no such thing as unimportant wetlands. That's just something that we need to get on the record. But there's about three different curves that seem to cross within these urban growth boundaries, and it's very frustrating when people look at these acreages and with an eye toward development of them. They can be filled. They can, in fact, be built upon. But typically, that requires a significant mitigation issue. And in one case we discussed just today, the cost for developing a mitigation plan and doing the mitigation was over $300,000 for a relatively small parcel to be mitigated. The statute favors on-site mitigation. That's sort of the way we want to see things done if we can. And if on-site mitigation proves to be infeasible, then there is the possibility for off-site mitigation or access to mitigation banking. Most of those tools are too expensive and too difficult for small developers to avail themselves of. Consequently, what happens is that you look at the lands inventory in small cities and find the wetlands are just in the city, they're functioning at various levels, and they're probably not going to be developed. And so the interesting consequence of that, maybe it's an unintended consequence, is that there's pressure to increase the urban growth boundary, or there's pressure to do off-site mitigation. And in any case, it makes it very difficult to attract people to do the development on these lands inside the UGB or inside the city limits. So if your overall goal from 40,000 feet is both to protect wetlands and to develop with inside the urban growth boundaries, the closer you get to that issue, the more mutually exclusive those things tend to become. So we've sort of tried to float a concept, and we're in the process of getting some feedback from city managers and from agency folks about what it is that we might do to approach this thing from a different perspective. And that is, acknowledge the fact that if you're going to do anything in a wetland, you need to do mitigation. But mitigation may be on-site or off-site. What we're proposing or will be proposing is an amendment that will allow a city of a certain size, and we're arguing about whether or not that's a city of 50,000 or a city of 25,000, or is it all cities, that if they have a wetland that is considered to be a non-significant wetland, You know, we tried to get people to agree on what an isolated wetland is, and there isn't any agreement. There may be isolated wetlands, but there's no agreement on what they are. We tried to get people to agree on what a wetland was that was not connected to a waterway, and there's no agreement on what that definition would be. There is, however, some statutory language that talks about non-significant wetlands, and that's in Goal 5 of the land use planning rules. And that definition allows the local jurisdiction, in fact, to have planning jurisdiction over non-significant wetlands. So in a case of a non-significant wetland in a city under 25,000, what we were looking to be able to do was to allow the developer and the city to agree on a payment to Mitigation Bank and DSL for their mitigation bank work. The city's portion of that payment, whatever that might be, could be used to do local environmental protection, local habitat restoration, local environmental improvements. So just to try to put this in perspective, a developer comes, there's a piece of ground, it has a portion of it that's in wetlands that the city determines that it's non-significant wetland. In lieu of going through the on-site mitigation process, which can be fabulously expensive, or having to mitigate off-site, the developer would make a payment to the city and to DSL. The city's portion of the payment would go to environmental improvements of some kind to be determined by the city, or direct mitigation. And then the DSL payment would go to the mitigation banking system. So there is mitigation. It's a cash payment in lieu of on-site mitigation. And what that would allow these small cities to do would be to look at their lands inventory and their wetlands inventory. Take a hard look at their non-significant inventory of wetlands and offer a process to a developer that would allow that developer to make a direct payment, which would be considered their mitigation, and then develop those lands. Obviously, from my perspective, it is an economic development opportunity in small cities. It is not intended to be a threat to wetlands because, in point of fact, there'd be a dollar amount paid for mitigation of wetlands to the mitigation bank or to the city itself for improvement of the environment. And it could be anything from planting trees to improving the function of a wetland that is significant that needs some ecosystem restoration done on it. So I'm sort of wrestling with a concept that we see in some other agencies. In Department of Environmental Quality, for instance, there's a process whereby if you have a good record environmentally and you prove yourself over time for in recognition of your performance, you're allowed not to have so many inspections, and you prove that you meet or exceed the standards. In other words, it's sort of a back door out of a regulatory process for high performance and possibly the additional payment of fees. Also in DEQ, if you have a permit processing that you want to put on an expedited basis, you can do that with an additional payment. In some very small wetlands, there's a wetlands program that allows a payment. I think it's on less than 0.2 acres in lieu of mitigation. And what I'm trying to do is look at those concepts and the impediments that I see to developing lands within the urban growth boundaries in smaller cities and remove those impediments, not by ignoring the need for mitigation, but by creating mitigation that's a cash payment. So we're working on the amendments and trying to figure some definitions. We've got feedback from city managers that like the idea. We're working with some of the organizations to see if their members like the idea. Nobody's taken any official positions yet. But the feedback we're getting from small cities is that it would be a valuable tool. It would give them some cash payment to be able to do some of the environmental restorations within the city that currently they cannot afford to do. It would entice some development into the urban growth boundary and the city limits, which currently is being prevented by the fabulous cost of mitigation. We haven't set the dollar amount. We're talking about something around $20,000. We understand that the average mitigation bank is between $40,000 and $45,000 per acre for mitigation. We've talked to the mitigation bank operators in the state of Oregon and find that they are not oversubscribed. As a matter of fact, they've sold very few mitigation acres, even though we've had the program around for quite a long time. And it's because the statute favors on-site mitigation as opposed to off-site. So we're hoping that you'll think about, along with us, and perhaps help us try to find a mechanism that would let small cities entice development, but also do that in a way that recognizes mitigation is necessary. And instead of putting people through a process that's pretty Byzantine and very expensive, cut right to the chase of mitigation and put the dollars on the ground in the city and in the mitigation bank at DSL.
Thank you, Ted. I want to clarify that you were referring to a proposed amendment to this bill.
Mr. Chairman, I hope I made that clear. I'm talking more about the relating clause of this bill. It does touch on the issue of mitigation banking and wetlands, and for that reason we're here to just vet the concept of a sort of, okay, you've got some small isolated wetlands. Nobody can agree what an isolated wetland is, but we do have statutory language that talks about non-significant wetlands. So if you've got a non-significant wetland in a city and you want to do a development, this could be a mechanism that provides the necessary mitigation to allow that to go forward.
Also, Senator, is it your understanding that the Corps of Engineers has defined non-connected wetlands?
There's a lot of definitions floating around, but the problem we have is that some of them are in litigation, some of them are the result of litigation. We don't have very good coordination between the definition of terms at various jurisdictional levels, but there does seem to be a clearly understood non-significant definition in Goal 5. And if we could agree what that is, that might be a mechanism to allow something like this to happen.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator. While I am intrigued by some aspects of your proposal, there are a couple of things that elude me. You're making the assumption that it's always going to be cheaper to do business with the cities.
Senator Meserly, to the Representative Johnson, if we set the payment in statute, then it would be the same for all of the small cities that we choose. But no, I'm not assuming it would be cheaper for cities, and I think it's all site-driven. You know, I think the mitigation costs are different for every site depending on the kind of report that you get.
You're also, you alluded to, in one of your other examples, a backdoor for high performers out of a Byzantine regulatory environment. This doesn't seem like it connects high performance or good stewardship or a track record of good behavior with anything. This seems to be the get-out-of-jail-free card, that you come in, write the check, leave the problem to the cities. The cities then are able to define environmental mitigation any way they feel like it, and one city's beautification project might be another city's culvert, might be another city's improved intersection to keep more trucks off of Highway XYZ. That strikes me as a little tiny bit problematic, and maybe I'm not understanding your concept in its fullness.
No, I think actually you have understood a good portion of it, but let me see if I can clarify. There is in various statutes in the state of Oregon what I'd call off-ramps for various programs, and some of them require higher performance. Some of them just require a higher fee at the front end. So I referred to both of those. I think they're at the DEQ. And yes, you're absolutely right. Every jurisdiction is going to look at its environmental objectives differently. Some folks will want to expand outdoor recreation by buying land for a park, and they're going to call that environmentalism. So others are going to plant willows in the creek and maybe fix culverts, as you suggested. And I think the process of making the fee divisible between Division of State Lands for their wetlands mitigation program and the city of jurisdiction sort of provides an averaging leveler for that. In other words, you are going to get some mitigation on every project, and that's where the DSL comes in with payments directly to the mitigation bank. In other places, you're going to see the cities defining their environmental objectives in the way we would expect locally elected officials to do that. And some will be better than others. So that's true.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee?
better?
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the opportunity to bring forth a concept. We are working on some amendments, but I think those are going to really depend on what kind of agreements we can get from associations, organizations, cities, and jurisdiction.
Okay, let me ask once more, Senator Dukes, did you have any questions?
Sure.
I do.
Oh.
Ask your question.
That's okay.
Apologize.
That's okay. If it only was as easy as a get out of jail free card.
You would want to see credentials on it.
Yeah.
I like this sort of idea. I like, but with some parameters. And so my questions are just to try to see if I assume the parameters are there. But I started reading through it once I got my glasses. I'm slow.
Actually, Mr. Chairman, to Senator Dukes, I don't have anything on paper. All I've got is a series of concepts.
You've got a bill.
Yes, you have a bill with the right relating clause, and I'm here to speak to the possibility of an amendment that would do some things.
So you're not speaking to the bill
and
as
I am
is.
Not.
Never mind, I don't have a question.
And Mr. Chairman, I can almost guarantee you if her question was germane to the bill, I would not have been able to answer it.
But I'd be happy to talk with you about your things other, outside as you're working along.
Well, thank you.
See
and
if I can come up to speed before we get here.
Intriguing feedback from cities. They like the concept. Naturally, they want to know what the details might be. They are concerned in some sense that that we don't create a solution that creates more problems. So we still would need a permit from the Corps of Engineers. There still might be the possibility of need to do surveys for endangered plants and species. But those two things, if we could agree on a definition of non-significant, then maybe there'd be an opportunity for small cities to move forward. And I will do that just now, Mr. Chairman. I'll move forward. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, we have Rod Johnson, who is more than 100 miles away. So, Rod, would you like to testify?
Thank you. I, too, would like to speak. First off, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for your time. Apologize for not getting dressed up appropriately for you. I had no idea I was going to be here today, so I hopped in my little plane, Betsy, and flew up here. Anyway, the proposal that Senator...
This isn't relating to airplanes, and that's what we show. We're
everything relates to airplanes
ride.
Somehow, Senator Dukes.
Okay.
I also would like to address the general concept, but also the bill, too. The bill itself is a bill that's been worked on by some other people more directly over the session. And I support the general concept that it results in, which is at some level at the end you have a process where if a person is trying to develop a piece of property, they can pay in lieu of mitigation into a state fund to create a fund that would... there after some time develop wetlands somewhere to compensate for the loss of wetlands in this development area. And essentially this bill is probably the things that Senator Ferrioli were talking about is probably more germane to this bill than he gave himself credit for, because one of the things we want to do is just slightly modify that pay in lieu of mitigation part of this bill to have a little subset, a little subparagraph of sorts that would say, instead of, right now the bill says that the payment would be the average that wetlands banks are charging, and there would be a little subparagraph that says except in small cities, in rural cities, coastal cities, southern Oregon cities, eastern Oregon cities, places that need economic development right now, not 2 years from now, 4 years from now, they need help right now. Anything they can do to help pick themselves up is a now thing, not a later thing. Let them go through the process of identifying what the wetlands are, and then except for the lakes and ponds and rivers, because that's filling in rivers is part of what DSL does. Well, that's not what this bill, what my little subparagraph would be about. It would just say that in the things that aren't rivers and lakes and ponds that are wet all the time, let economic development take place by having this payment in lieu be, instead of some average out there, have it be, and Senator Ferrioli mentioned 20,000 an acre. Just have it be some kind of system where in these rural areas that need the economic development on areas that aren't wet all the time, and that's, we're having trouble figuring out where this line would be. We define where the wetlands this stuff would apply to. I don't know what non-significant wetlands are under Goal 5. I'd have to figure that out. But in my mind, it's really easy to know the difference between rivers and lakes and ponds and stuff that's on a hillside or that's you can walk around on without drowning. anyway, on those things you can walk around on without drowning, let small cities have some economic development there by having an expedited clean system for paying $20,000, for example, into a fund. And there's a concept that Senator Farioli has introduced, which is part of that money go to the cities themselves, and part of the money go to the ESL for this other stuff, and both those monies be used for environmental enhancement activities of some sort. In the meantime, let the cities have the people in the cities have the economic vigor of the development. That's the basic thing. And he, when he mentions the amendments that he's working on, I'm working on those with him, and some other people were trying to figure out the best way to carve a reasonable exception into this thing that would make it so that instead of waiting 2 years, 4 years, whatever, for things to become possible, we come out of this session in 2003 with a bill that says, okay, you're in a small city in rural Oregon that needs development. You now know that you go through the process, identify where those wetlands are. Unless they're really wet wetlands, then you know you can pay $20,000 and get the job off the ground. Okay, that's where we're at. And I, again, apologize for not dressing up. I thought I wasn't probably coming until Wednesday or Friday, but we wanted to explain this, give you a little heads up, because the amendments are being drafted and refined, and then we'll hopefully be able to come before you again with and actually let's see the words on the paper.
Okay. Appreciate it. Questions? Senator Dukes?
Rod, I know it's not specific because it's not all tied down yet, but you threw out the number 20,000 a couple of times. Is that 20,000 an acre
yes.
in here?
Yes. I'm sorry. Yeah.
Thank you.
And again, you get into definitional problems. 20,000 acres would be directly filled or removed, or not. I don't think it'd be appropriate. Wouldn't be helpful if you did an acre over here and somebody was able to make an argument that 300 yards away there was a wetland that got somewhat affected by whatever you did here. Somehow you got to draw some lines and say, okay, 20,000 acre for the stuff that's removed or filled, or put a road across an area or something, and you measure that amount of acreage and you pay that money and go.
Is one of my concerns will be where you restore it.
Mm-hmm.
I was giving somebody recently an example. In my district, in Clatsop Plains, I have a flower, and I have an endangered butterfly. And the endangered butterfly really likes that flower. And there aren't very many of these butterflies around, apparently, and there certainly aren't very many of the flowers.
Right.
And so if someone could come in and make an argument that they needed to fill an area where some of those flowers grew, maybe you could do that if you were moving down the road to restore it. But if you were going to then restore it in Clatskanie, you probably couldn't get those flowers to grow, and it would be beside the point. So I think if the idea, and we're going back a long way here, but if the idea of wetlands is for critters of varying magnitudes, then if you're going to restore a wetland, it probably ought to be a similar kind of wetland for a similar kind of use. So those are the kinds of questions I'll have.
Yeah, and that's a valid concept. I would just throw out, I guess, that there are Endangered Species Acts in place that have some direct effect on development.
Absolutely.
And non-development. If you start trying to pull too much of that into this, then you get overlapping and it even gets more confused. So.
Just as soon as you're not trying to wipe it out.
No, as far as I know, that hasn't even been discussed about it. It's a new kind of new thought. But if there was an endangered plant or animal or something, a worm or something out there that needed protected, then it has its own set of protections under the Environmental Species Act. As far as I'm an expert on everything by a long shot, but that would be the place I'd look for that protection.
Other questions? Thanks, Rod.
Thank you.
Coming up.
I'd like to invite others. I've got three more people signed up to testify, but we do have another sign-up sheet on the table. If there's more people that would like to testify here at this public hearing, please feel free to sign up.
I'd like to next call Dick Nowitzki and David Impolsky. Are they here? Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, Committee. We appreciate the opportunity to have a very brief statement to make. I'm Dick Nowitzki. I'm a principal in two of the mitigation banks in
private mitigation banks in the state of Oregon. David represents a third one yet, and we are trying to speak on behalf of the mitigation bankers in the state. We have participated, at least I personally have participated, in developing 2899 as we now see it. And there was a lot of negotiation going on. Nobody got exactly what they wanted, but we feel that as it stands, the bill will help us all continue to make a program that is working, work better, work simpler, and be more streamlined, and happen more in a more timely manner. So the mitigation bankers, admittedly, are not getting everything we would like out of this document, but we feel that the system is working now. Bill 2899 would help make it even more effective and more efficient. So we would support 2899 as it stands.
Dick, could you give us your name for the record again?
It's Richard Novitzki, Novitzki. I'm a consultant and wetland banker. I'm in Corvallis.
Thank you.
Welcome.
David, would you like to testify?
I would just second what Dick has said very helpfully.
Not at all, huh?
Yeah. Improve on that.
Any questions? Senator Dukes?
I was looking at Section 7, and I think I understand why it's in there. I just wanted to ask if there was any room to change the language a little bit. Agencies can be a real nuisance when they don't get around to having their objections in a timeline that would actually do some good. And I've seen that happen. But the language that says that if they don't get it in within 30 days, the director shall assume that the state agency, local government, or special district does not desire to provide comments. Concern me, and also the language that says that they shall not be bound by comments. I agree they're not bound by them, but I guess I'm wondering if there's some language that we could come up with that would say, not make it sound like, don't worry about those comments, they're not important, assume that an agency meant something that they may not have meant. I believe that what you're probably trying to get at is if you have serious comments, get them in within 30 days. We're giving you that 30 days. Pay attention to it. It's serious and it's important. And I would agree that if they don't get it in within whatever timeline we give them, that they're out of luck. That there's a timeline there and we're serious about it. And it makes it sound like the agency doesn't have to worry about the comments of the other agencies, even if they get them in within the 30-day timeline. And also that if they drop to the ball, then we're assuming that this other local government or whatever out there, because they didn't get theirs in, or she's saying that we are assuming they meant something. And I don't know that we can assume they meant anything. I think we can just say it's too bad, it's too late. But I hate to assume that they didn't care because they didn't send comments, because we all know that oftentimes they don't send comments because somebody went on vacation. So I'm not suggesting that they be able to come in later and submit those comments and have them be of any consequence. I'm only suggesting that the language that assumes what they meant by not submitting comments may be more than we ought to be doing. So, and I know this is carefully crafted, so that's why I'm asking.
Sure, and just let me say, Senator, that we're going to be asking John Lilly to come up when we get to the public comment.
Okay.
And that's a good point to ask questions. Yeah, it's also valid here.
Because I'm assuming that this is here because of you and others like you, maybe?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Duke, we aren't quite so involved in this exact issue because we're kind of after the fact, the mitigation bankers. However, we recognize that in order to get to the point where a mitigation bank credit might be a viable option, have to go through this process. So expediting and streamlining and making this process more timely is desirable. And you're absolutely correct. They were very carefully crafted, not to say that there might not be room for improvement.
You're not specifically wedded to particular language. You didn't write this.
I did not write
okay,
that, Senator.
I got you.
And however, we agreed with it because, again, it's an attempt to streamline and expedite and make more timely the process.
Let me ask you, how many mitigation banks are in the state?
At this moment in time, there are 7 banks that are private. And the West Eugene Bank is a quasi-governmental, quasi-private, more governmental bank than private.
How many acres are in all these seven banks?
I don't know the answer. The two banks that I'm involved in have each generated approximately 35 credits. I think some of the other banks are a bit larger, so I would imagine that we're in the range of 200 acres, credit acres.
And if you can, if not, there'll probably be other people testifying who could answer this. The public bank, at Lane County or Eugene or someone, would they only use their credits for public projects, or would they be for sale for the private sector too?
Mr. Chairman, they're also for private and public sector uses, and they have agreed to sell their credits at approximately the same cost, because the cost for them to develop their program has been underwritten by federal dollars and state dollars and county dollars. However, they feel that the cost is a legitimate cost across the board, so they are in line with what we're charging at other banks in the state.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Mel Stewart.
My name is Mel Stewart. I live here in Salem. I represent only myself. It's a very small group. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. To the bill. First of all, on page 10 of the bill, and again on page 12, there is a section. Page 10, it's lines 9 through 11. It says, If offsite mitigation is proposed, the applicant shall document the impracticability of on-site mitigation. Now, because of the words there, I'm taking that to mean that if the applicant is within the service radius of an existing mitigation bank, he still has to mitigate on-site. And I question the environmentalism of this. Because if you mitigate on-site, the chances of you having a failure and effectively producing nothing as a result of a very costly activity is about 50%. If you ask the applicant, as the Corps of Engineers does, to use a mitigation bank if one is available, not only do you streamline the process, but you gain almost 100% success, better functional values. Now, if I'm an applicant, I come to DSL with three documents. The first document is a delineation chart, how much wetland I have. The second is a seven-page application. And the third is a concerted mitigation plan. That's what you have here. It's about three-quarters of an inch thick. As you can imagine, DSL spends most of its time dealing with these kind of mitigation plans. Now, if they allow the uses of a mitigation bank, you don't need this. All you need is a check. Now, that streamlines the process. It also saves a substantial amount of cost to the state agency, maybe $300,000 to $400,000, maybe more. And you gain better functional values. So in the bill, I would take out that. If there's a mitigation bank available, that would be my first choice from an environmental standpoint of allowing that applicant to use that. Cost the applicant less, better environmentalism.
Chair, can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Would you adjust that statement based on size? For example, if you had a whole lot of swampy area and you only needed a piece of it, you may be able to actually extend on the other end of it and have a viable project.
Sure.
Whereas if you've got a small one, I agree with you completely.
Absolutely. So I would not ever exclude, I would never force the person not to do an on-site mitigation if they wanted to. In fact, the League of Oregon counties, I've talked to them about this. In some cases, it's important to them, and I'd let them do it. But if they have the choice, by all means, let them use the mitigation bank.
So this language might be okay if it were for projects above, beyond a certain size?
Well, to give you some idea, I went in and personally reviewed 619 permits between 1995 and 2000. In fact, I reviewed all of the permits. Three out of every four DSL permits are less than 0.5 acres in size, about 0.25 acre, inside an urban growth boundary. And what this means is you've got DSL staff running out to every one of these little 0.25 acre parcels. Via DSL's own documentation, it's next to an impossible task. It involves a tremendous regulatory cost, and it doesn't result with very much benefit at the end of the day. So, next of all, so I get rid of that line of the bill. Next of all, on page 8, there's a definition of functional values. On line 7, I would make a minor modification where it says such as, I would say which are, to make it more explicit what functional values that we're actually trying to regulate and trying to control. Page 7, page 8, line 7. I would like to change such as to which are. Other than that, I did take a certain amount of time to review the Mitigation Bank Revolving Fund. I have some knowledge of that. If you have any curiosity of what's been happening in that fund, I spent a fair number of hours trying to sort out where the money came from, where it went to.
Okay. Questions?
Senator, did you have more questions?
No, except that that change is a little bit larger than you may realize on page 8. Big change.
It does change the tone, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you, Phil.
Thank you.
Well, I mean, Phil Scholes.
Good afternoon. My name is Phil Scholes. I am one of the about five members that worked as a work group putting together this bill. And so I can answer some of those questions. Mr. Lilly behind me can probably answer some of the other ones that I can answer. What I'd like to start off by saying is that, you know, we started off with some pretty grand ideas, and in order to meet the compromises in the legislative process, we whittled out quite a few things. And some of those things were expressed by Senator Ferrioli. We definitely feel, as wetland consultants out there, that there is a need to carve an express lane so that permitting gets through there, that it shouldn't be so difficult. But we found in trying to, you know, craft legislation that it's not that easy to get all the sides to agree to that. And so we made the compromises to put together a bill that we felt would make some improvement to mitigation banking as a whole, do a little more streamlining that's a sort of a bit of a follow-up to Senate Bill 529 from the last legislative session, and to, you know, correct a few little kinks in the system. By no means can we, with this particular bill, solve the big problems. It would probably take us a couple years to really figure it out and get the kind of compromises. So really what we tried to present to this committee and to the Land Use Committee was something that we felt would get all the way through both houses and the governor's desk with a signature. At this point, you know, we don't support more amendments because we would feel like we've sort of made a lot of those compromises, and any significant changes may jeopardize, you know, getting through the other house and maybe getting a signature at the end of the day, kind of thing. But I think there were some points brought up that are worth discussing. I did write a lot of the language, or was maybe the scribe that did a lot of that. And some of the questions that came up, I'd like to answer. One relating to the Senator Duke's question relating to the comments from agencies. This is really just some language we put in there to sort of prevent regulatory agencies and resource agencies from just dogpiling comments on top of comments. And giving the Division of State Lands the authority to help sift through those that are pertinent, those that relate to the thing at hand, and those that are put aside. The Division of State Lands, by their own administrative rules, can't just ignore comments, but they do have the right to say this one is not appropriate and this one has to be responded to. And so that's why that language was put there. If something is needing a little bit of tweaking, I think we're very much in favor of doing something like that. Mr. Stewart brought up a suggestion on expanding or modifying the definition of functional attributes to changing the word are, and we feel that would probably be too limiting to put that into the statute at this time. I think let's see, the other thing was on, I guess, page 10 in section 7. And that was the issue of regarding mitigation and looking at on-site mitigation opportunities initially. We went a lot back and forth with this issue quite a bit in our work group. And it really comes down to is that the environmental community feels very strongly that at least a discussion needs to go on when you talk about mitigation about what is available on site. Sometimes there are creeks, wetlands on site that have an opportunity to be improved, and they'd like to have the public record say whether it's practical or not to work with those as part of the mitigation. That is something that is currently required by federal rules and that we can't change here. It's been sort of a long-standing policy. Sometimes, you know, it requires us to do mitigation that we haven't felt really great about. And we hope over the next couple of years, with some additional programs that Division of State Lands working on relating to their statewide general permit, that we can get past some of those. But it's not a solution that is very easily worked out. And removing it from here does not remove the hurdle that exists, sort of a mere hurdle in the federal process. And so we were definitely keeping in mind trying to keep the statute somewhat consistent with the federal standards all the way through the process. I think the other thing that is real important regarding some of the comments that Senator Ferrioli made, you know, has to do with creating something for local governments to gain from the mitigation process. And as much as I think that is a great idea, I don't know how we can, you know, efficiently sort of craft something, put it in this particular bill, and then be able to work it through a process and get the compromises. It's a real major change, even though it's one that I would probably support in the long run. It's just one that it's hard to sort of figure out how to fit it in something that's already been slimmed down the way it has been. That's pretty much it. I could have gone over sort of some of the details of the bill if it had been helpful, but I sort of figured all of you had at least some exposure to this.
Okay. Committee, what I'd like to do, if you don't mind, bring John Lilly up and let him, and both of you stay there too, Phil, and then we can maybe get into some real in-depth questions on the bill itself. So, John, would you like to come up? And did you have any, well, yours?
Sure, thank you. Members of the committee, I'm John Lilly, the Assistant Director for Policy and Planning for the Division of State Lands. Like several of the testifiers before you, I was a part of the work group that worked on this bill. And just as a quick comment, I would say that this bill has been in two House committees and attempted to be a part of four different pieces of legislation until it came to this point in House Bill 2899 as amended. We're supportive of the bill. We've worked with the consultant community, the mitigation bankers, the environmental community, and others to getting it to the point that it is today. It does speed the permitting process. In fact, it knocks 10 days off the completeness review requirement that's under current state law. So we go from 40 days for a completeness review to 30 days. It does conform, it was carefully worded to make sure that we weren't running, while we were being innovative and on cutting edge, that we weren't moving too far afield on this mitigation idea, that we would find ourselves at odds with the federal process. And I think that one of the litmus tests that the land board and the director has given me in terms of looking at wetlands legislation in this session is to make sure that we move forward in a way that adjusts the statute if necessary, but not in a way that would kind of make it more difficult for us to move forward with the statewide programmatic general permit process or the 404 assumption process, which are key ideas for the land board in pursuing this whole idea of permit streamlining at the state level.
Okay, I think we're also in the legislation is definitely moving in the right direction. Representative Johnson?
Two questions. The first one is, both of you have made reference to the work group. Could you share with the committee who all was on the work group?
The work group consisted of myself. I'm a private sector dwelling consultant, another private sector consultant by the name of Nick Coffey, who has a business here in Salem, Mr. Lilly with Division of State Lands, Dick Novinsky, who already spoke, who operates Mitigation Bank, and Mel Stewart, who already spoke. And later on in the process, we had Liz Frankel, not officially as part of the group, but we worked with her to get her input and feedback on those issues.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Out of the composition of this group, was there any sector that was conspicuously absent, or people who had wanted a place at the table who were denied such?
No. I mean, early in the process, that was a claim made, and we corrected that. At a latter part in the process, we got the Oregon Farm Bureau, the Cattlemen's Association. Help me, John, here.
We're blank.
Let's see, the
League of Women Voters,
but also with the Association of Oregon Cities.
Yeah.
Or whatever they're referred to.
League of Oregon Cities and the Association of Oregon Counties.
Yeah. We got input from all of them, as well as several other representatives in the House on that issue, on their concerns.
And so if I put the question to any of these groups that you mentioned, did you feel that your participation was full, complete, valued, they would all step up and say, you bet?
I think they would.
Okay.
If they've had objections, they have not voiced it to us in the last, I would say, 30-plus days.
Okay. One.
I think, Representative, we had a letter from Mr. Lilly defining that, if I got the right letter, in which most of the public input was through the Division of State Lands process themselves. Is that right? Is that a fair statement?
Mr. Chair, yes, through the work group primarily, and as Mr. Scholes has said, late in the process, we had a work group meet, an expanded work group meeting, where we had the cattlemen and the Farm Bureau and others at the table, went through the proposal in great detail, dealt with their issues, and either made word changes or excised completely from the amendments any objectionable language.
So let me ask, clarify the question. John, I did get this letter to interested parties. Was that not sent to the entire committee then?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure what letter you're responding to, the recent letter we sent on rulemaking.
No, it's on June 3rd, 2003, subject remove and fill rule revisions, background of House Bill 2899.
Yes, sir. That was a letter that we sent to inform folks that have been involved in our rulemaking process. We're doing some minor changes to the rules just recently.
But we'll get copies of that.
And it was
question on a new subject. You, Mr. Lilly, made particular note of saying this is going to speed up the permitting, particularly the completeness review. And I know that we've been sitting in this same room hearing agencies talk about reductions in available resources to agencies and discussing the impact that those are going to have, the inability to keep up a good flow of work. You're knocking 10 days off, and I know that in your budget presentation that there were complaints about adequate staffing to meet the tasks that you were currently assigned. Are you going to be able to keep this schedule given any fiscal limitations in your agency, or are you setting up the agency to not be able to perform?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, currently we're meeting a 27-day turnaround time on completeness review based upon the current workload of individual permits that run through this process. That's why we were willing to agree to a 30-day reduction from the 40-day requirement to 30 days. In consultation with my colleague, Mr. Purchase, who runs the field operations side of the business, his feeling was that the 30-day limit would be is achievable with existing staff resources.
Well, if this bill becomes law, would you be amending your performance measures to track this kind of permitting schedule?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, certainly. If we've got new statutory requirements, we'll reflect those in our performance requirements.
Thank you.
Other questions? Senator Dukes?
First, I wanted to say thank you. You're a rare breed in the Capitol these days. You actually went out and worked hard through the regular process to work out a deal, and you're here defending the deal. It's unusual these days, and believe me, I appreciate it. But Representative Johnson raised an issue, or at least your answer to her raised an issue, that I'm curious about. It sounds like there weren't any of the sort of definable environmental groups sitting at the table with you.
Initially, yes. And part of it is to my own and some of the other members of the work group, our own ignorance of not knowing necessarily how to put together legislation.
I mean, I wouldn't want to suggest, Mr. Chair, that the Cattlemen's Association and the Farm Bureau didn't strictly meet the definition of environmental organizations. You can be wrong here.
The work group was set up by Chairman Garrard, and he appointed those five people. And when the committee first got together, some discussion went, we had some discussion about should we include an environmental group, and initially it's like, well, do we even have the authority to bring someone in? And so we sort of dropped the ball for a couple of weeks, well, probably close to a month, as we sort of worked out the language. We got to a point where we felt like we had crafted something and we needed feedback, and we picked the ball back up, and that's when we made a couple of phone calls, and we ended up talking with Ms. Frankel on this issue.
As good as she is, I don't think League of Women Voters qualifies as an environmental organization either.
No, but there, a lot of the environmental groups look to her on her feedback. And I think that several groups were, I know that Nature, no, hold on for me. I'm the name here.
CSC. Conservancy?
Nature Conservancy.
Not Nature Conservancy, the person we initially talked to.
Nature Conservancy.
Okay, the Nature Conservancy person was asked, but that declined to get involved because it didn't seem like it was of as much interest to them.
Yeah, but Oregon Environmental Council or whatever the other ones are out there, I don't
know. We did not contact them.
Okay. Thank you.
I've got a whole list of questions here. First of all, do either one of you have a response to the proposed amendments that you heard about? Senator Ferriol and former Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I've spoken with Rod Johnson on a couple of occasions about ideas, and his idea has certainly changed or been developed over time as a result of his research and the conversations we had. At this point, I feel that there is generally there's sufficient authority within the division's rulemaking authority to tease apart the details that might where we might work on an expedited process for small wetland fills. I think I need to remind the committee a little bit about the mitigation process in general. I think Senator Ferrioli did a good job of speaking to a lot of it, but some of it is pretty complex. And the bottom line being that when a wetland is filled, one of the things that is done is the functional attributes of that wetland are to be compensated through mitigation. And there are at least three ways that that can happen. Either it's done, the mitigation or the functional attributes are replaced on site, or they're replaced off-site, and if they go off-site, they could be creation enhancement or restoration of a wetland someplace other than where the project is, or there could be payment to a mitigation bank by credits from persons like Mr. John Polsky or Mr. Nowitzki, who have already done the work and have restored the wetlands, or in the last instance, that a payment could be made to the Division of State Lands Revolving Fund account. And then Division of State Lands is on the hook, so to speak, to go and find the replacement or the mitigation and do the and either contract with a third party or do it ourselves to do creation, restoration, enhancement to replace those lost functional attributes, hopefully within the same resource area or watershed that the original impacts were made. So that's to say that it isn't quite as simple as taking $20,000 for compensation, and as example, and giving some to the local community to do their idea of mitigation, and some into the revolving fund for DSL to do their idea, because the federal government under the core 404 process, permitting process, is expecting the functional attributes to be replaced, just as the state law contemplates, and the core won't have that assurance if some monies are provided to local government, and local government interprets how they want to do what environmental benefit they want to find in their community. The system, until we have some streamlining devolving to the state level, we're going to be stuck with trying to design these mitigation processes so that the applicant goes through functionally one door as much as possible. That is, satisfies the state's requirements, and the state may have a little flexibility and helps to create the assurance that the federal government's requirements will be met as well.
Mr. Scholes, did you have a comment on that?
I don't support the amendments. I think that they require a lot of discussion in order to get consensus, to get the same consensus that we've gotten up to this point. I would be happy to meet with Senator Farioli and Mr. Johnson regarding what they want. I think some of those issues require some changes to different parts of the statute that have never really been part of this particular bill.
Mr. Lilly, could you help us out in the difference between the definition of wetlands with DSL and the Corps of Engineers, because I think that's kind of what we're bouncing around here to some extent, at least.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll start out and I'll leave it to, if you please, Mr. Scholes, who's an expert in the field. Basically, there's no difference in the definition of wetlands as applied at state law or federal law.
Except that it applies differently, doesn't it? I mean, there's one difference that the Division of State Lands takes jurisdictions over wetlands that are not connected to waterways, and the Corps does not. Is that an accurate statement?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's not that clear, not that unclear, rather. The Corps and the state's jurisdiction are pretty much synonymous. There has been a federal court case called the Swank case dealing with a landfill pond in Cook County in Illinois, which has given rise to a lot of misunderstanding amongst all of us over how federal law is applied to waters of the U.S. And in that case, what happened was the Supreme Court said that the Corps did not have jurisdiction over this pond if it was isolated and it's only there was no connection to another water body, and its only reason for taking jurisdiction was because migratory waterfowl used it.
And at least maybe I'm the one that's confused, because I know that there's been issues over lots town that because of drainage off of the lots held water, but they were not connected to a waterway.
The Corps recently has been applying as best they can this Supreme Court standard, and there have been times in recent months where they have waived jurisdiction in areas where the state has jurisdiction, but they're still using the same standards, and the migratory bird rule is the standard that they're no longer using.
If I might add, that particular federal ruling, in my experience, has only eliminated the federal jurisdiction on about 2% of the situations that I come across. It's pretty small for those of us in Western Oregon. Just about everything seems to have some kind of surface water connection, and so it hasn't had much of an effect. And so when we get into discussion of isolated wetlands, we're talking a very, very small slice of the pie here.
Along those same lines, isn't it true that NRCS does the wetland delineations for ag lands for the Corps, and does that apply as well to DSL?
Mr. Chair, DSL does all delineations for state jurisdiction, or reviews all delineations for state jurisdiction, whether they're on ag lands or any kind of resource lands. There is a memorandum of understanding between the Corps and the Department of, U.S. Department of Agriculture. The NRCS will do delineations in on agricultural land for certain purposes. For example, if there's a need to identify the limits of a farmed wetland area in order to be qualify for a federal farm program. And Phil does, I'm going to pass it to Phil here a little bit. Phil is a little bit more familiar with the ins and outs of that than I am. Maybe he'd like to comment.
Is that in conflict with your
program? Mr. Chair, no, we don't think so. We use the Corps of Engineers manual for determining jurisdiction. There is a Food Security Act manual that's very, very similar to the Corps manual. I think it differs in one or two small regards, small points. But basically, we're still looking at many of the same parameters. I think the difference in ag land is that in large parts, farmed wetlands are what they are. They're farmed wetlands, so they've been put to the plow. There's some of the vegetation is missing from the component. So you're looking more at the soil saturation and the soil itself. And wintertime judgment as to the and growing season judgment as to how much water is there on the site is a consideration for jurisdiction.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, maybe the question you're getting at here is there a difference between federal regulation of wetlands and on ag lands versus the state? And there is quite a bit difference. The federal program essentially has a fairly large exemption to it, which they refer to as prior converted croplands. Essentially, anything that has less than 15 days of consecutive ponding and is farmed in some type of manner is pretty much exempt from federal wetland regulation. The state doesn't recognize that kind of exemption, and so you can have a pretty big difference. A delineation I did down in Eugene about 5 years ago next to the Eugene Airport had on a 105-acre parcel had 64 acres of wetland using the 87 manual, which is what DSL relies on. The federal manual, which evaluates things differently because it was agricultural, came up with about 8 acres of wetland. So that may be an exaggeration of the typical, but there are significant differences between those standards. And it's written into the statute at this time of how converted wetlands are dealt with. And although I would have liked to address that issue, that is a fairly nasty piece of thing to untangle in our state statute at this time.
And I would think the farther west you get, probably most of it is wet 15 days out of the year or 15 consecutive days.
Yeah.
Mr. Lally, you want to respond to that?
If I may make a follow-on comment, it would be a misunderstanding, I think, if I left the table and didn't say that the exemptions for agricultural practices, farming and grazing and agricultural uses, even on converted wetlands under state law, those activities are exempt from the state's removal fill law, even though if those same lands were to be converted to a large strip mall or residential housing facility, that activity would be jurisdictional. That activity would be regulated by the state, and my guess is it would also be regulated by the federal government when the land use changes.
Another question, a concern that crossed my desk. When wetlands are preserved within a drainage district, are those wetlands allowed to be managed consistent with the purpose of the drainage district, or you could apply that to irrigation districts too? And I think the concern is that if people mitigate wetlands within those kind of districts, you can see where it deteriorates from the ability for the district to function, at least to share the cost. Is there any work done there at all?
Mr. Chair, If a mitigation site were to be developed within a drainage district, as a part of our permit review process. We have recently included drainage districts and diking districts in the circulation process. So it would be our hope that those organizations would respond to the permit application at the time that it's being circulated. Secondly, I think it's real important that those comments come in, and we are sensitive to those, because we know that it's possible that the maintenance of the diking district or the drainage district could defeat, or rather the mitigation activity and maintaining it could defeat some of the purposes of the drainage district or the diking district. So the time to deal with that is at the time when the application is moving through the process. And during our prior rulemaking, some folks down in your part of the world didn't have a concern about that, and so we stepped forward and included those districts in our circulation process so we could make sure that as early on as possible we weren't going to run into counter one another.
They've become aware of it now.
Yeah,
okay.
That's good.
Could I pay you back?
And if the drainage district makes comments that are negative to the mitigation, what weight do you give to those? Answer carefully.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, since I don't handle the individual permits, I can't say precisely. I can say what I would like to see happen. I would like to see those taken into account in and the modification of the mitigation plan done, so that if we're able to approve the permit with the mitigation plan, then the concerns of the drainage district or the diking district are addressed. If, on the other hand, you simply can't achieve the mitigation goal and the goal of the diking district, then or the drainage district in this case, it may be necessary to find a different mitigation site.
This was channel deepening versus the Clatskanie Drainage District. That's why I said answer carefully.
I was just going to mention that mitigation plan is in essence a proposal by the applicant to replace those wetland resources that they're proposing to impact. And they're the ones that actually have to guarantee that this mitigation plan is going to work. And so if a drainage district and an irrigation district has a negative comment, then they're the applicant, and usually it's the consultant that's doing the work for them, and needs to respond that it would or would not work, and maybe we have to start over in some of those situations. I think there's a much increasing awareness of these issues. We're finding that sort of not on the other side of drainage districts are irrigation areas where mitigation areas may be sustained by irrigation water. Well, irrigation districts don't want to guarantee that they are going to always have extra tailwater to provide into a mitigation area. And so Division of State Lands, their staff, I think, has warmed up to the issue and said, you've got to plan on your mitigation not having that as a source of water, because someday it may be cut off, especially if an area becomes more urbanized. So it's part of the evolving science that we're sort of dealing with.
I hope it gets worked out, but our situation was somebody who needed to do mitigation was looking at places to do that to compensate for a very large project. And then they found a spot, and it was inside a drainage district where the patrons were paying to pump the water out. So,
Well, and I want to be more specific, John. What I'm hearing you say is that if a drainage district or an irrigation district files a complaint in the hearings process, that the division would not damage that drainage district and would require another mitigation site?
That's not what I heard him say.
Mr. Chair, I think it depends upon...
Yeah, it's stronger than you.
on
purpose.
Mr. Chair, I don't know if I can go that far, but what I... it depends, of course, upon the nature of the comment and what the mitigation plan is. That we're dealing with things that are fairly abstract that, I think the hope is that the permitting process and the comment, like Phil says, the comment is going to trigger a response from the applicant. The comment is going to trigger a response from the resource coordinator that handles that permit and say, look, we can't maintain the diking district and achieve mitigation here without one or the other moving. And I think it behooves us to try to straighten those things out. Because in all likelihood, if we would turn around and approve the permit and somehow compromise the diking district thinks they're compromised, it's going to be fodder for a contested case. And, that's that's not necessary if we know ahead of time.
Well, and just for a little bit of history, some of those drainage districts have been in place for over 100 years. Yeah. And for an action such as this to become in and make them invalid or inoperative, I think is, I agree, would be wide open for litigation, I mean. Not really not fair to the, and I think there's a fear of many ranchers and farmers that a lot of people in the country and society just assumed they were no longer functioning. Operations. And my concern, and I've had a lot of years of experience in this, is that a lot of those farming areas were developed with state and federal funds, a lot of investment put into those operations. And so it's a huge policy discussion whether they should lose the ability to operate those systems or not. And we've seen it in the Klamath Basin. We've seen it all over the state. It's something that the department should move very carefully, not harm others involved. So you've been there before. I know you have. Got a couple other, three other questions, actually. Does this bill allow the mitigation fund that you have within the department to buy credits from mitigation banks? Or have you always been allowed that?
Sure. I have to look at the statute to see what it currently says.
Yes.
But thank you, Bill. The bill would allow the state to use the revolving fund account to buy credits in special circumstances. For example, if, as I've said before, if there were monies paid into the revolving fund under this payment to provide concept, and then a bank was developed within that same watershed, then the state could, through the revolving fund, then buy credits from that bank. It's kind of a sequence issue.
So is this new to this bill, or has this always been?
Well, my colleague says that we've always had the ability. It's been a little while since I've looked at the statute, Senator. I need to refresh my memory.
The work group has always had this concept as part of it, that monies could be used from the state fund to purchase mitigation bank credits.
Before this bill comes is approved, they could. The division could do that without the bill?
I do not believe that the division has the authority under the current statute to do that. We created a line item in how they could use the revolving fund monies to address that issue.
Mr. Chair, it certainly makes it clearer under the 2899 provisions. Under current law, under 196.650, where it defines the use of the account, subsection 2 says that the account can be used to pay costs for incurred for alterations needed to create, restore, or enhance wetlands. And legal counsel believes that we could expend dollars for mitigation credits under those provisions, although I don't think we've done so of late.
And that was my next question. My understanding that you have bought very little, if any, credits from mitigation banks, this revolving fund.
Mr. Chair, I think you're right. I'd have to go back and check precisely. Part of that is that there are, as Mr. Nowitzki testified to, there are six or seven banks active. The revolving fund has been in place for quite some time, well on 10 years or more. So there could be some catching up to do.
And my point in really pursuing this is that we've set up the mitigation banking process in the state of Oregon. And if the division is not able to utilize those banks, we put some of those investors in a tremendously difficult position, I would think. One other question, two others, but they relate together. I read in some of the material that I received that credits were only allowed for banks or from wetlands. And if you recall, Mr. Lilly, in 97, I passed a bill through the body that allowed projects by landowners in the Oregon Salmon Plan to have value for mitigation. And not all of those projects We were talking about riparian zones and other projects other than just developing wetlands. Has there been a shift in definition here, or is there a problem with how that bill would apply to the bill we've got here today?
Mr. Chair, I think you're referring to 196.623, where it relates to watershed enhancement projects. And some of the banks, as my understanding, have been certified for to accept or to sell credits for some of those watershed that would like watershed enhancement type projects. But I don't think we fully realize the benefit of this particular statute provision of the statute. I think what we're looking for is some property owners to come forward and have sites certified under the mitigation banking requirements, where we could then identify credits that would be available for compensatory mitigation. And I just don't think we fully realize this. Now, I think in part it's a marketing issue, number one, making folks more aware of this opportunity, and number two, just not having many opportunities to really put it to work.
And just to clarify the issue, what I was trying to develop was a process for some financial gain, not to totally match the cost of what some landowners were doing outside of grants and those kind of things. I feel very strongly that landowners do a lot of things on their properties free gratis, quite frankly, and get no benefit from it. And this was that's where I was trying to go with the bill in 97, was there ought to be some way for them to get some compensation for the work they're doing without costing OWIB or anyone else any funds. Is that being talked about at all?
Mr. Chair, certainly. The structure in the statute is there. The structure and the rules are there. We just haven't found any takers yet. And like I say, it could be because we haven't marketed it well enough, or we haven't, and people are not aware. And then thirdly is that when folks get into create a mitigation bank, they are making a long-term commitment to keep the land as it is, because it is mitigation to compensate for some development that's gone on someplace else. That provision may not fit with what the landowner wants for the long-term use of his property. They may want to maintain greater flexibility.
So you raise another issue. If someone owns a mitigation bank and there's a natural event that changes that bank forever, at least it would be extremely costly to put it back in the original shape. Do they have to guarantee that after they've sold the credits?
Mr. Chair, I don't know the answer to that question. I'm you've raised it and I'm curious now. I would be glad to research that and get back to the committee.
Oh, because I think that's the reason why some of these landowners haven't got involved, because it was just too big of a liability. They had to guarantee it for eternity.
For example, if somebody were to do riparian planting and et cetera, and then the river came up and took that out, would they have to replace it? Is that the kind of thing you're thinking about?
Or we've seen shoals, we've seen landforms change, major slides or whatever, floods. We've seen huge deposits of sediment and a lot of different things that could really alter the values of mitigations. Thanks. Okay, so that's my list. Does the committee have any other list? Thank you very much. Appreciate your time.
Did we know when this comes back?
Do you have anything you need to add to this? That completes our list of public testimonies. Is there anyone else in the audience who'd like to testify? Liz?
Would you like a little response on this right decision? I could say that for later, but it's the federal Supreme Court decision that does color this whole picture quite a bit. It's whether the federal jurisdiction committee is in play as much as the state would have you believe. As a lawyer, I could give you a little bit of a background on that.
Let's get Liz first. You put your hand up first. You have to testify, Liz. Actually, excuse me.
Rod, could you put that in writing for us, and then maybe we'll take it up at our next hearing? I'd appreciate that. And some of us, I know, have got other appointments we can get to here this afternoon.
Ms. Frankel with the League of Women Voters. I think I need to say two things. Well, one thing I feel I need to say, and the other you're going to get because I'm going to say it. The first comment is that the League of Women Voters has three arms. One has to do with governance, one has to do with social policy, and one has to do with natural resources. Under natural resources, the League has a long history, a very powerful history, having to do with clean water. And that is part of the reason that I'm involved with this. That spills into what I want to say, and that is, we're talking about clean water. That's why people care about wetlands. They have many functions that come under the heading of clean water. Once you want or feel that wetlands have a value, then you trip into the process of trying to figure out, do you protect them, when, where, and so on. It became obvious in the 80s that there were times when wetlands would need to be destroyed for good public policy reasons. It was at this time there came a very profound concept of balancing. This is called the no net loss policy. And both of the Bushes as presidents raised this. The state has been concerned about no net loss. In other words, you didn't want to lose any more wetlands in toto than you have now. What this led to was mitigation. That is the way in which you maintain that balance. And it's well to remember that that's the purpose for mitigation. In other words, mitigation goes all the way back to protecting wetlands and to the Clean Water Act. That's where we kind of follow this process. Sometimes I think we lose the concept behind mitigation. What we're trying to do is to figure out ways that we don't lose wetlands. And I guess that's the end of that little homily. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
With that, I'm going to close the public hearing and adjourn the committee. Thank you.